Well, the title kind of works as the summary itself. Everybody is wrong about God. I think that the kind of big problem we have is that we talk about God in theological language, and I think that's a mistake because I don't think operatively, when people talk about God, that's really what they're meaning. And so this book tries to lay out kind of the psychological and social underpinnings of what people mean when they say the word God.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, you are wrong about God, but fundamentalists are even more wrong. And Kim and Derek talk DragonCon. All coming up next. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Beau Bennett.
And my name's Peggy Knutson.
And we're back for another edition of the Humanist Hour. Peggy, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bo. How are you?
I'm doing great. We were both at Skepticon not too long ago, and
yes.
I understand that you have a story to share.
Well, I found one of the speakers quite interesting. His name was Destin Sandlin, and he has a YouTube channel that has over 3 million subscribers. He has a channel called Smarter Every Day. So he is a scientist and does scientific experiments and posts them on YouTube. And it was quite interesting.
And what was really weird about that is somebody posted on Facebook, and for the first time, I don't know, it may have been that I saw his name and it kind of registered unconsciously, so I noticed it in my Facebook feed for the first time, but I was actually at the hotel reading through Facebook and I saw a video of his. I'm like, oh, that looks really interesting. I'm going to save this to watch it later. And then like 10 minutes later, I go into the main room and there he is. He's given his speech. So I thought, wow, that is a coincidence. That's a miracle, almost a miracle from God.
It was meant to be, Bo. They should look up the chicken video.
The chicken video.
The chicken video. Yep.
All right.
Enough said. I
know. Was he the Christian speaker?
Yes, he was a Christian speaker. And that was the other fascinating part for me was he did discuss threshold of belief, where it did seem that his threshold was much lower for his particular religious belief system than it was for his scientific inquiry.
Did he talk a lot about that? Did he talk about like what kind of Christian? I mean, is he like an evangelical or is he just, yeah, you know, I believe in God, I guess,
he didn't really touch on that other than he said he had a personal experience and that was the cause of his belief.
Yeah.
Well, but interesting, you know, he's raised in Alabama, so of course his personal experience is of Jesus,
right,
and not of Muhammad.
Right, of course. Of course. Oh, so interesting. All right, well, let's get into our interview for today. We're going to be speaking with the author, James A. Lindsay, of the book Everybody's Wrong About God. And you called him Dr. James Lindsay. Is he a professor in
mathematics?
In
yes.
Mathematics.
And he did his undergrad in physics.
Interesting. Okay, cool. All right, well, let's get him on the line and talk to him. And Peggy and I have the pleasure of speaking with Mr. James A. Lindsay, the author of Everybody's Wrong About God. How are you, James?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
We're doing great. So, in about, I don't know, 1 to 2 minutes, give us a summary of this book, Everybody is Wrong About God.
Well, the title kind of works as the summary itself. Everybody is wrong about God. I think that the kind of big problem we have is that we talk about God in theological language, and I think that's a mistake because I don't think operatively, when people talk about God, that's really what they're meaning. And so this book tries to lay out kind of the psychological and social underpinnings of what people mean when they say the word God.
So when you say everybody's wrong about God, is that title meant to be a little bit like a little shocking, a little clickbaity, saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not wrong about God, I'm an atheist?
Yes, of course. And if you're an atheist, you probably are wrong about God.
Okay. Because we have a lot of, I guess, even atheists kind of adopt this theological perception of God, right?
Right. It's, I think that we all tend to argue about or talk about God in the language of theism, and what this book is about is trying to get people to look at it differently. I don't want to say to stop doing that because it sounds kind of commanding, and that's not the idea. But if you think about the topic the way that it's being used, I suppose. Think about the word God, the way it's being used. Theology is kind of like this mythological structure laying on top of the beliefs, and the beliefs really are servicing or allowing people to pretend they don't need to service certain psychological and social needs. And so I think it's kind of like if we talk about the ocean in terms of Poseidon, we're doing something wrong, and we wouldn't do that now. So I think if we talk about what people need in terms of, you know, feelings of understanding, of control in the world, and further societies, then we're really going to address what's going on when people are talking about God and help them create a space to where if they can, they can walk away from those beliefs because they don't need them.
Hmm. Are you defining God in a way that believers today would not define God?
Believers will not agree with me at all, and a lot of atheists will not agree with me at all. But I'm trying not to define God. Like I said, I think that God is a mythological construct, which is kind of a story that, or it's a little more complicated than that. It's sort of a attribution schema where people, that's a fancy term that basically means way people explain things, that fills in a lot of gaps, helps them make sense of things like morals, makes sense of how the world works, purpose in life, gives them a sense of control, and helps them understand their context in society.
Right. You know, I hear people do this all the time when they're explaining what God is to them. What they're basically explaining, at least from my perspective, is certain psychological attributes that, like even cognitive biases or something that's going on in the brain, and they're calling that God. And then there's also those people who will call God the unknown, for example, like God was the one who created the universe. So they're making a few different assumptions there. One, that the universe was created, and it was created by this being that is known as God. It's interesting. It's interesting to try to pin somebody down and ask them, you know, what is your definition of God exactly? And as you talk about this, it turns out that, well, if we could take all these attributes of God, what you think is God, and if I could show you that, well, this attribute is easily explained by this or this or this, you know, would you kind of remove those qualities from God, and what would you be left with? It's an interesting conversation to have, but I've never quite seen it work in a sense of getting people not to believe in this mythical being.
Except I think the main point that you made there is that you called it a being.
Yeah. And I guess I don't call it a being. I think that usually people
believers
that,
call right, it a being.
Right, right. And, you know, what exactly is a being?
So just because it kind of fits with what you said, I want to say actually that the sort of origin of where this idea that I had with the book, where it came from, is having exactly those kinds of conversations where, you know, people would talk to me about God and what they mean by God. And I've always been, I mean, probably always, at least back since I was a teenager, been interested in what do people really mean by the word God? And I had, you know, different phases where I believed in all kinds of crazy stuff trying to figure that out. And this book really is the result of doing, since this is the humanist hour, I'll say something profoundly humanist. I actually just started listening to people who believe in God and listening to what they're saying and what they're trying to convey when they use the word God. What are they speaking to? And a lot of times it's morals. A lot of times it's purpose. A lot of times it's a sense of control. Of course, there's the whole denial of death aspect. And sometimes it's a sense of community. And then I started reading religious psychology, and the pieces all just go straight together. So that's where this book came from, is listening to people have these conversations and then realizing, hey, that's really something that they mean something when they say God. We don't have to not take them seriously because we don't believe that there is such a being, but we need to take them seriously in terms of what they're really trying to reach to, not in terms of the mythological structure or the pseudo-philosophical language that they're expressing it in.
Sure. Well, do you have some kind of suggestion or goal in this book when somebody does explain God to you in this way, and you have this understanding of God that's a little bit different, that may be science-based or psychology-based? How do you communicate that to them, or do you even bother communicating that to them? Or is this book just for people so they could understand what they might be thinking in terms of what they believe God is?
So that's two questions, both of which are fairly hard. The second question is a little bit easier. Is this book mostly to help people understand? And the answer to that is yes. How do I have conversations with people? I've hit a point where I've realized that it's typically not very fruitful to have argumentative type conversations with people. And for somebody to say, blah, 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 God, blah, 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 and me to answer, oh yeah, you mean you're talking about your sense of moral attribution. That's almost pure condescension to say something like that. And it's not going to be a fruitful conversation to hijack what they're trying to say in their own language. Instead, I just try to meet them where they are and what they're talking about. And I'm not terribly opposed to using the language that they're using, although I don't ever kind of cave in and be like, well, yeah, I understand. I believe in God too, in the sense that, well, I don't say things like that because I don't believe in God and I don't want to encourage that. Instead, I say things like, I hear where you're coming from. I can relate to that. And, you know, I don't believe in God, but the way that I see, and then whatever they're talking about, maybe it's morals. The way that I see morals kind of comes like this. And then it just seems like a more open-ended, honest conversation that doesn't have that confrontational element that is so often associated with atheism. And so I do hope it changes conversations, not that I would prescribe how, but rather that when people understand and they use their own sense of humanity and compassion to talk with people, that they will have conversations that are more fruitful, that actually speak to what people are doing instead of arguing with them about something that's at least one level and maybe two levels removed from what they're really talking about.
Tell me, what is your view of the term atheist? And I believe there's a chapter in the book, The End of Atheism.
Yes, chapter 2, The End of Atheism.
Why is that not the title of the book?
It was going to be, but we decided it wasn't punchy enough. Actually, the first thought for the title of the book was Ditching Atheism, which was decided that was too coarse. And so I don't remember all of them, but I think I proposed 18 or 19 different titles for this book. And then all of a sudden I hit upon Everybody's Wrong About God. And of course, the second I tossed it at the publisher, he was like, yes. Cause I like Bo suggested, you know, it has a little bit of that punchy, I don't want to say clickbait, but you know, get your attention, rile up your cognitive dissonance and make you want to see what's inside of it. But it's actually also accurate. If you're talking about or thinking about God in theistic terms, then everybody is wrong about God. Or everybody who's doing that is wrong about God.
What terms should we be talking about God if we don't talk about it in theistic terms?
I don't think we should talk about it in theistic terms at all. And in fact, I don't really think we should talk about it at all. So for instance, the question, do you believe in God? The answer is no. Well, how do you account for morals? Nowhere in that, as somebody who doesn't believe in God, do I have to bring up God or talk about it in terms of lawgivers or any of this other stuff.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Peggy Knutson, and we're speaking with author James Lindsay about his book, Everybody's Wrong About God.
None of the conversations actually require you to talk about God at all. How do you deal with the idea of death? Well, how do you feel secure in, you know, if a disaster happens that you'll be safe? You know, all the conversations that are relevant don't require us to talk about whether or not there's this omnipotent, omniscient, you know, properties, divine attributes, philosophical nonsense entity out there. And we don't have to think about it that way. We can hear people who are talking about their beliefs in God and listen to what they're telling us and have conversations about what they're telling us without having to play into the conversation on terms that miss the point.
So I guess when we're talking about the term atheism, then it's just kind of the opposite of theism. You said that you don't want to use theism anymore because of that reason that you just described. So therefore, not wanting to use atheism is the same reason. Does that make sense?
So yeah, atheism is a term that stands by its very coining in direct opposition to the word theism. So theism talks about religious, or I should say, theism talks about belief in God, not religious belief, because there are non-theistic religions. Theism talks about God in a particular kind of language that is at its bottom mythological. It has created a kind of personification that summarizes you know, explanations about the about various aspects of the universe, and does so in the kind of thing that myth always does. It gives a narrative. It talks about it answers questions like why without explaining how. Sean Carroll called those immature models. So God created the universe. That seems like it answers the question of how the universe got created, if indeed it did.
Right.
And yet it doesn't answer any question, because the second you say, well, how did God do it? You're in exactly the same position as somebody who doesn't believe in God. You know absolutely nothing more.
Right.
And so that's a hallmark of mythology. So atheism is a term that basically could be taken. I mean, I reject this mythology, but that's not usually how it goes, because atheists tend to be people who have embraced the idea that we should talk about God in that same mythological language and then fight it on its own terms. And I think that was important, and I think that needed to be done, and I think it has been done, and it's time to start moving on. The goal isn't to create an atheistic society. The goal should be to create one that's left religious belief, especially theistic religious belief, behind what I've termed a post-theistic society. I'm not wanting people to start calling themselves post-theists or any of that. We don't need so many labels. It's just the difference between an atheist, though, and a post-theistic person would be that the post-theistic person has decided to accept the fact that most of the conversation about God has been on the wrong terms and is largely irrelevant, whereas an atheist wants to argue it on the same terms as people who argue in theological language.
Gotcha. Okay. You know, it's funny when you were talking about the whole idea of, well, how did God do it? God created the universe. Well, how? And people could usually just go one step further and say, well, God's magic.
I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Right, a miracle, they call it. God did it via miracle.
Every explanation I've ever had, and having grown up in the American Southeast, I've had a lot of these conversations. And I grew up as a science kind of kid. You know, I majored in physics in college, and the sciences were my favorite subjects in high school. I took all of them I could at the high school I went to, and I had a lot of these conversations. I'm surrounded by creationists. And so, you know, how did God create the world and or the universe or whatever? And the answer is always, well, he just did.
Right.
Or he's all powerful, so he can do that.
Right. Right.
Well, and that doesn't answer a question.
It also comes down to that age-old argument that you just have to have faith, which is basically saying you have to believe first to become a believer.
Correct. Faith is actually, the way I see it, is kind of like a seal. We can think of it like plastic wrap put around beliefs that keep them from being re-examined.
That's a good way of looking at it.
And when, by the way, when people are saying stuff like the universe was created by God, how? Well, he just did it. What they're actually doing, like I said, using that fancy terminology, is that they have an attribution schema, a way of explaining the origin of the universe. And what they're doing is they've created a word, God, which follows from Aquinas, the blah, blah, blah argument, blah, 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 first cause, such and such. This we call God. You know, that's all of Aquinas's arguments are some weird explanation, and then this is what we call God. So Aquinas really could be seen as, in a sense, the intellectual predecessor of everybody is wrong about God in a very distant kind of weird sense. But what they're doing is they're creating an attribution schema in order to explain a mystery. And that's what we've called the God of the gaps for a long time. In the book, I say they're using God as a term of phenomenological attribution. They're attributing the explanation of some phenomenon to a mythological construct.
You know, and you really can't put too much blame on people who do this, because if you look at people like Einstein and even Stephen Hawking in his earlier days, they used the term God, but perhaps in a little different way, didn't they?
Well, yeah, I think so. Of course, that's one of those age-old arguments where people want to gibber and jabber and get these people on their side. But yeah, I mean, they definitely used God, and it certainly was something metaphorical. What they meant by it, I guess, is up to them. But I seriously doubt that it had much in common with what, let's say, the Westboro Baptist Church means by it.
right, exactly. Yeah, I believe Einstein said even it was like the embodiment of the laws of the universe, something very metaphorical. And Einstein specifically said this has nothing to do with a personal being or the personal God that Christians imagine. And Stephen Hawking in his later days came out and said, no, I am definitely an atheist, and whenever I use the term God, I'm talking, you know, metaphorically, and the same thing as pretty much Einstein used it.
Right. I mean, the idea of an ultimate explanation for the biggest mysteries, it's like kind of it's a nice cotton ball to stuff in a hole in what we know, or maybe what we can know. So it's kind of like epistemic stuffing to make us feel better, or, you know, Linus's security blanket or whatever at the end of the day. Right. And I would encourage that we don't use the word God to mean that as much as possible, because as I've said before, bad analogies perpetuate the God delusion or something like that.
Yeah.
Millions of believers and a lot of the people I know really aren't that well versed in intellectual arguments regarding the existence or non-existence of a concept of God, but do we just stop rebutting any of those intellectual arguments? Do we stop meeting them where they are at their level there?
I think rebutting the arguments is a bad idea. And let me talk for a second. The fact that your average believer, which really, really aggravates Christian apologists, by the way, I think it's hilarious. I listen to them get mad. I see them write their things or get on their talks, and they're like, the average Christian does. They did this a lot with Peter Boghossian's book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. The average Christian's not equipped to deal with this, which are just basic, honest questions. Like, right. Really? And they're not educated in these sophisticated arguments. Well, that's because the arguments aren't actually relevant until the beliefs feel challenged, which tells you that the arguments, the theological structure, the pseudo-philosophical discussion is actually secondary or tertiary to the beliefs. So that's, again, where did this book come from? It came from the idea that these people who believe are believing for some reason. Why don't I listen to them? What are they saying? And at the bottom, what they're talking about are things that they need. So how do we have the conversations? I don't think rebutting them in most... Now, there are going to be cases where they say something that's clearly way out of line or damaging or whatever, and rebuttal is sometimes appropriate. But in general, having a sophisticated or quasi-sophisticated, I don't know, some sophisticated philosophical or argumentative argument with somebody isn't likely to change their beliefs. In fact, it's likely to cause the backfire effect. It's likely to do what Pete called, throw them into doxastic entrenchment, make them double down on their beliefs because they feel threatened, they're confused. The beliefs are what are serving their needs, and the arguments are there just to protect the beliefs. So you're attacking the wrong thing. It's like, I don't know how much you know about old school military strategy, but you don't punch the guy's shield. You try to get around it or past it. And attacking these arguments is like punching the shield. That's what's there to protect them. I mean, what good is that?
Hmm. And yet a lot of those philosophical arguments are new to people who might be questioning or doubting. So they,
right.
We do have to deal with those,
yes,
at a certain level.
I think that's what, and I say so in the book, I think it's very important not only that there are good anthologies, or that's not the right word, good archives of rebuttals or answers or explanations of stock theological arguments, but I don't think, you know, I don't think it's terribly fruitful to have, say, half of the people who don't believe in God that happen to be on Twitter trying to engage in these arguments with everybody they find that puts hashtag atheism or hashtag Jesus. I really don't think that's doing anybody any good. And right. Actually, again, since this is a humanist hour, I don't think it really, it's not a very humanistic thing to do, to go attack people like that in a way that's likely, especially if your goal is to dislodge belief or help people, I should say, dislodge their beliefs that are held by faith. You're not likely to succeed by doing that. So, I mean, what are you achieving? You're being a jerk, and you're not achieving your goal at the same time. Sounds like a winning solution.
Yeah. You know, I found that when speaking with different theists, I tend to classify theists into two general categories. And the one category is basically just through this line of questioning that you're talking about. Like, for example, if they say, well, if I say, what is God to you? And, well, God is that idea inside me when I choose to do the right thing. So it's kind of like an intuition type. So I say, okay, well, you know, we have that as well, or atheists have that as well, and we call that intuition. And I could explain it cognitively and how that happens to them if they like. But basically, what I'm doing is I'm talking to them and trying to get these commonalities that we both have and we both share. And when, at the end of the day, they call it something, they have a theological explanation for it. I have a scientific one. Either way, we're both on the same track. However, I find that we diverge with some people when they start focusing on the obedience end of theology. For example, like they don't just look at like their hearts, for example, for the right decision. They will literally turn to the Bible and look for guidance compared based on the commands like in the Bible. And that's where it bothers me, because now that's a complete, that's not just like a moralistic, it is part moralistic, but it's also like a rational argument that you could argue with them on a rational level as to why are you being obedient to this book? You have to explain this to me because I just don't understand. And I think that that's the group that I generally have problems with.
Yeah, generally speaking, I think those people are lying somewhere on what we might call a fundamentalist spectrum. They're getting more fundamentalist. And I do propose a kind of idea that in the book that's a partial, I think, definition for fundamentalism, which is important because there's already been some talk about should we treat religious fundamentalism as though it is a legitimate psychiatric disorder or psychopathology. And of course, that's extraordinarily controversial and people lose their minds about it. But if there's a way to kind of grade it, then you can start to look at that. And the definition that I put is that when people are going to turn toward religious attributions, so turn to the Bible in order to make sense of their what they should do morally, for instance, that's dealing with moralistic attribution, as opposed to taking natural attributions when they are available, that person, to the degree that they're doing so, is behaving as a fundamentalist. It's understood at least somewhat why people do this. It turns out that the belief structure, like I said, is servicing a large number of needs. If you know, in the book in chapter 5, it covers, you know, something like a dozen or more large psychosocial needs that belief in God is dealing with. And essentially what happens is the observation that religious psychology has made is that people will tend to accept natural attributions or explanations when they're available over superstitious or religious ones, unless the natural explanation threatens the overall belief structure and causes them some kind of larger psychosocial discomfort. And so in this case, you know, people who turn to this level of obedience, they have, I mean, metaethicists, moral philosophers would say, well, they've got a deontological moral, blah, blah, blah. They have accepted as one of the moral precepts of their belief structure, of the moral framework that their religion stands to mean for them, that they've then tied up with the sacredness of God, that following the dictates of the scripture is the correct thing to do. And this, of course, is a fairly gigantic problem in the world. Yeah. Right now, people deciding that they're going to literally follow the dictates of barbaric ancient holy books that might lead to mass murders or other ridiculous things. So ultimately, in a sense, you can say there are kind of two types of believers. They're the kind that are more fundamentalist and the kind that are less, with a fuzzy boundary between them. And those obedient ones are ones who have a moral attribution framework that they call God that includes the idea that the scripture is the first, last, and only word on how to behave, which of course reveals them as hypocrites immediately because they don't, I mean, half of them have tattoos and hate gay people, which it's the same book in the Bible that condemns both of those.
Are you saying that with the more moderate believers, less fundamentalists, if we attack the elephant as a whole, it will backfire rather than just taking little bites at a time? You know, we can't eat the whole elephant and get rid of the concept completely, but if we deal with it and face each one of those little moral issues, maybe we'll have more success.
Peggy, I think it's illegal to eat elephants.
It might be illegal to eat elephants. But if you do eat an elephant, you must do so one bite at a time.
That's right. If we try and face this whole concept, it might be much more difficult and make people double down, as opposed to just that you said they had would accept naturalistic explanations until it goes against their fundamental belief system.
Right. Often what actually it triggers for the more moderate believers is it triggers their fear of death. So generally speaking, then, what we can think about it this way instead, maybe instead of eating elephants, which I think they're endangered, so we can't do that. what we can think about is that there are a large number of psychological and social needs that are being met by belief in an entity called God. That is going to actually be individually different for every believer, depending on where their psychological and social needs happen to be. And the more of those that they have an opportunity to meet without having to rely on their belief structure, the more space there is for them to leave their belief structure behind and to accept natural explanations instead. What I have found, two things. One is that people, no matter what, change their belief structures slowly. I would say that from the initiation of maybe I don't really believe this stuff to, yeah, okay, I've really put that away, is probably for most people just a guess. I'm making these numbers up. There's not data. But I would guess that's an 18 to 36 month process for most people. This doesn't happen quickly anyway. But the other thing is that I've noticed is that it doesn't matter how moderate or liberal or whatever a religious believer tends to be. There are places where if you poke them, they get really upset real fast. And you don't even have to poke intentionally. It can be just kind of casual conversation, and you get too close to something that has to do with one of the needs that they don't know how to deal with without their belief in God, one that causes them maybe, like I said, often it's fear of death, so an existential crisis, or one where they literally, I mean, most moderate believers are moderate because they have a fully developed sense of how morals can work without having to believe in a moral lawgiver called God.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Peggy Knutson, and we're speaking with author James Lindsay about his book, Everybody's Wrong About God.
But it could be any one of these things. It's usually going to be, like I said, fear of death, sense of control in life, or a sense of purpose or meaning in life. And if you get too close to these things, they react almost as badly as fundamentalists do, although they would deny it. Mm-hmm. They end friendships. They sometimes go kind of berserk. They start saying what sounds like a personal, perfectly rational, kind person starts saying, you know, fairly vile or mean or even stuff that sounds kind of like theological gibberish because you've poked too close to a fear. And so now they've hit kind of this like desperate fall into the arguments to protect those beliefs that are dealing with those needs. And so I think that generally the goal isn't so much to eat the elephant, so to speak, to pick and pick and pick. It's just to continue creating space into which people can walk out of their beliefs. The more space there is in which they feel like they can walk safely out, the observation of religious psychology is that the more space that they have to do that, the more likely they are to do so. Fundamentalists are a different ballgame. Fundamentalists are ones who will choose their religious attributions over natural ones because of some deeper seated need that, again, like I said, could serve as the basis for defining it as a psychopathology because there's some serious hole in the way that they understand the world that's causing them to literally freak out if they take so much as a step away from any part of their belief.
When I was taking a course on psychopathology, and I had a copy of the DSM and talking about all these different disorders, what I found really interesting was many of these disorders had a little out clause in them for a religious exemption. So, like, if you're like seeing things, if you have these delusions, and if you're talking to people who aren't there, and then you have except if it's a religious belief. So that that kind of does away with this idea of pathology. I don't know why they do it. Perhaps it's a strong cultural belief that every culture has, so we fit in, so we're actually normal, so it's not like somebody who's out there very different. And because it's part of the cultural norm, nobody stands out, and therefore it's not bad for the individual. It's actually good for the individual and their social well-being. And that's why a lot of religious behavior, no matter how crazy it may seem to us, is not technically classified as being pathological.
Yeah, I have a pretty actually nuanced, which is to say complicated, view on that particular matter, which I think is a very difficult thing. The DSM-4, if I understand correctly, had an explicit religious exemption for delusion, but I believe they changed it in the DSM-5. So I had a paragraph about that in the book that I actually took out, because it's not in the DSM-5, and I don't believe that it's going to be in the DSM-6. So maybe, I don't know, I'm not deeply invested enough in what's going on in that community of academic psychologists to know exactly why that is. So I didn't want to speak to it. Yeah. But I do think, however, that most religious beliefs don't qualify as delusional because they're mistakes. They are people accepting a mythological explanation, which is just a mistaken way of interpreting what is actually there, what is actually real. And that's not the same as a delusion. And so an exemption doesn't even need to be made. You're not talking about a delusion if you're talking about just an error. But at the same time, many specific religious beliefs are delusional in quality. For instance, a belief that if you are sincere enough or pray enough or whatever, that God will spare your house from a hurricane is a delusion. That is an outright delusional belief. It's not true. That's not just an error in understanding the world. How did the world come to be? God made it. Well, why are flowers yellow? Because God made them that way. That's an error. That's just a crappy explanation is what it is. And in other cases, it's just an erroneous explanation for things that are real, not delusional. However, God will spare me from the tornado if I start praying right now.
Yeah.
That's properly delusional, and it's threatening to those people's well-being.
Absolutely.
And so it's a problem.
Yeah. Maladaptive is the word I was looking for. If you are praying for something, and let's say you have a child and the child has the flu or something and you need to take him to the hospital for care, and you choose to pray instead because you really believe that God will heal your child. Well, we know how that goes. We've seen too many instances of that happening, and that it seems like it is a very clear delusion. It's maladaptive, it's destructive, and a lot of people could get hurt seriously. But I don't think that that academic psychology has those nuances, because it is a very touchy subject, as we discussed. Because the moment you start, if it's a religious belief and you start calling it a psychopathology or a delusion or something, then we get into muddy waters. Like, well, how about believing Jesus rose after 3 days? Is that a delusion? And I know there are differences, but the differences aren't black and white, like between the different extremes, and it gets a little muddy. Well, anyways,
yeah, that's an ugly, ugly place, and it's very complicated. And I can sympathize with the desire to put a just blanket and say nope, but we'll just leave it out. Religious belief, totally different. The problem with that, ultimately, though, is that there are legitimate delusions, and there are even delusions that are religious in nature that are classified as delusions.
Right,
but the more of a blanket or a more of a removal from being willing to talk about it that way that there is among professionals, the more actual delusions that manifest religiously that won't get treated. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty serious problem. And I think it's one, again, humanists should really care about, because these are human beings who have a problem that's maladaptive. And if they're not receiving treatment because there's a taboo on getting too close to whether a religious belief is delusional or not, that's a pretty serious fault on the part of clinicians, and their diagnostic manuals and training should do everything that they can in order to try to correct that fault.
Right.
How do we explain this varying threshold of belief? I see it in scientists who have their threshold for belief for scientific inquiry is very high, and yet they may have had a personal experience, they have an anecdotal experience, so their threshold for believing in God is very low.
Yeah.
So I use an analogy in the book to talk about that. So again, like I said, there's maybe a dozen or more, and I don't claim to have named all of them. I'm sure that there are things that I have missed because it's impossible to be perfectly comprehensive on something like this in a first go. But there are, let's say it's 10, just for simplicity's sake, there are 10 beliefs or 10 needs, psychological and social needs, underlying what people mean when they say the word God. I use the analogy of a sound mixer board. So we've all, you know, seen the people in the sound recording studios and they play with all the buttons and knobs. They can slide this up and slide that down, turn up the bass, turn down the treble, and so on. Well, each one of those needs has a knob or a number of knobs, and people will slide them up to different degrees and that suit their personal needs. Where I was saying earlier about people having individual needs and therefore having individual meanings for the word God, the mixer board metaphor sort of explains how. So for scientists, for instance, their phenomenological attribution knob is turned all the way down. They don't need God to make sense of the world or universe. However, their sense of purpose in life, or their understanding of where morals come from, or their dealing with the factor of death, again, it's very common, or something like that, or understanding their context in society, which is often somewhere in there where all that symbolism is where you start getting a lot of these personal experiences. Those knobs might be turned up. A great example are the Vatican scientists, who are clearly deeply religious people whose phenomenological attribution knob is pretty much at zero. They accept pretty much everything science says, and they play the square the circle game of trying to mesh that with their theology. But they don't need God as, so when they say the word God, they don't mean something that explains the universe, except maybe as an ultimate uncaused first cause or some such. So that's kind of the difficulty. When I say, and you asked me, Peggy, earlier about how I define the word God, that's the trick, is it's not how I define the word God that matters. It's that every single person has a unique milieu of needs, and those needs determine how they define God for themselves. And those needs, because psychology is a constrained system, are often overlapping, or there are categories that are very common. Churches are going to, you know, or scriptures or whatever, what have you, religious communities are going to feed notions about how those definitions need to be understood. But ultimately, when we've said, and people have said it for years, that there are as many gods as there are individuals that believe in God, this is really what they mean. There's a lot of different needs that are at different levels for different people, and God is the kind of ultimate ad hoc explanation that fills in each of their needs exactly how they need them.
Yeah, isn't that convenient?
That's why it's ad hoc. That's why it's mythology. That's why we don't take it seriously as a philosophical topic anymore.
Right.
Or why we shouldn't.
Right. That's
great. It's why it's hard to combat it as well.
It is also because it is, you know, I don't know what the rate of theistic believers is. I know that there are, between Christians and Muslims alone, you know, we're talking 3.5, almost 4 billion people. So that's 3.5, maybe 4 billion gods. And I just committed blasphemy against every one of them. And
you're going to hell 4 billion times, James. Congratulations.
Well, what was it Mark Twain that said? You know, he said, heaven for climate, hell for society.
Yeah.
You'd be in good company.
That's right. That's the comforting thought. All right, James, this is great. We're going to have to wrap it up. Can you let our listeners know where they can get a copy of the book, Everybody is Wrong About God, and when?
The book is widely available on pretty much all of the major online retailers I know, and it should be working its way into some brick-and-mortar stores, although I don't know which ones are where. The publisher kind of has sway over that, and I think it depends on how many start selling is how many will start ordering it. So go buy the book, and it will be in more places. But certainly it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. There will be a Kindle edition, and I am presently recording an audio book version, which is a delightful experience if you've never had it. But that said, there should be three versions eventually. I would say the audiobook, you know, best case scenario, we're looking at maybe February or March, but Kindle will be released on December 1st, the official release date of the book. And for whatever reason, unbeknownst to me, but known to Amazon alone, apparently copies of my book that were pre-ordered on Amazon are arriving today instead of on the official release date in a couple of weeks. So today being the 18th of November when we're recording. So get it now.
Right. All right, James, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, and that was James A. Lindsay, author of Everybody is Wrong About God. What do you think, Peggy?
I think I'm wrong about God.
Yeah. Well, you have to be because you're somebody, and apparently everybody is wrong about God. So.
Yes.
All right, let's move on to an interview that Kimberly Ellington recorded for us. So this was back in October. Back in mid-October at the Atheist Alliance Conference that took place in Atlanta, Georgia. So let's turn it over to Kimberly Ellington.
So I am here at the Atheist Alliance of America Conference in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm with Derek Colonudo.
Yeah, I know. I got that.
Derek Colondino.
There you go.
And he is someone that I've known for a couple of years because of a little thing called Dragon Con.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
it's a very small gathering of me and 80,000 of my closest friends.
Yeah, you're
75,000 actually.
Yeah. But, well, they do. You have to say that not all 80,000 of them came through your skeptic.
I'm very glad they didn't. I don't have that much room.
So Derek does a lot of things, but why I knew him first was because of Dragon Con. If you've never heard of Dragon Con, go look it up right now. It's amazing. And he runs the Skeptic Track, which is where I hang out most of the time.
Well, that's the thing about Dragon Con. It was originally just a fantasy convention, fantasy sci-fi. But because of that, it has the roots there. But over the past, this next year will be the 30th year. But over the many years, they kept adding things. And I tell people, Dragon Con, if you like, whatever you like, what you're involved with, there is something at Dragon Con. I don't care what it is. I mean, there's people that are in their 80s who go to Dragon Con because there's things for them. It's just nuts.
It is amazing. And that's the funny thing I realized about myself, because when I first, my first Dragon Con, I was like, oh my God, these are my people. But really, that's not saying anything, because there's people for every kind of people there.
Definitely. Yeah. And the nice part is that you got 80,000 people who all are really nice to each other. It's an amazing thing.
And Derek does a really good job putting together a every year a completely new set of people with ideas. And on the Skeptic Track this year, we had Richard Carrier. Who else do we have? David Silverman.
Yep, we had Randy again.
James Randy was there, which was amazing.
I got with his husband
on stage. Yes, and Davey was there as well. Lots of really good information, and the room was, I mean, every year I see more and more people. All right, so tell our listeners what else you do. What the other reason why people might know you?
I do this little show called Skepticality. We've been doing it for, oh gosh, almost 11 years now. We started in 2005 before podcasting was in iTunes. This is back in the day where you'd have to be a hardcore geek to even know what a podcast was.
And you got that covered? You got hardcore geek covered?
Well, it's just funny. It's like, I just remember having to have a web page that told people how to subscribe to a podcast.
So you were a geek before being a geek was actually cool.
Oh, yeah. When we hit, like, back in the day, almost every podcaster knew all the podcasters. In fact, the first podcast convention, like, it was everybody. I mean, everybody was there. And, you know, now that's impossible. But back then it was, and this is before iTunes. Now, then iTunes hit, and the nice part is we have that distinct honor that we were, when they first hit iTunes on podcasting, on my show, Skepticality, went to number one overall.
Nice.
So there was a lag time. And then, so when Steve Jobs did the keynote, our picture was behind him.
Oh, God, that's awesome.
And it's something that will never happen again to anybody.
Right. But,
yeah, so that was actually really cool. And then, of course, that spiked our numbers way up. And we pretty much maintained pretty good numbers. So
very nice. Yeah. All right. Well, very cool. Anything else you want to share with our listeners?
I don't know.
No deep dark secrets?
I know. Oh, gosh. I think I'm pretty open about every dark secret. Yeah. So.
And then, of course, what happens at Dragon Con stays at Dragon Con.
No, it really doesn't.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. Not in the internet age.
Yeah, if you pay attention to Twitter during Dragon Con. Nah. Yeah, I think it's like there's that one event happened at DragonCon. There's some one of the cosplay women got assaulted.
Oh.
And it was a big deal, but I had to remind people. It really wasn't at DragonCon. She was going to DragonCon. DragonCon has a lot of security there.
Yeah, they do.
And now this year, a lot of people didn't realize that we actually hired a bunch of counselors. If anybody got harassed, anyone for women, right? They had like booths and anything, so you can do all of your, you can report things in private. And they had the forensic people, so if something happened, they actually held the kits there, so they can. So they took it seriously this year.
Yeah. All right. So you guys, you go to Dragon Con. Go just Google that, and you'll
Labor
have a really
Day
good time.
Labor Day every year.
Labor Day weekend
in Atlanta every year.
You can have 80,000 friends too, just like
yes.
Derek.
Like I said, I think our official number is 74,800 this year.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
But so yeah, make it 8,000.
Yeah, sure.
So everybody
by
is
next
listening.
Year.
Yeah. So if everybody listening, if y'all come, we'll hit the 80,000 mark.
It's a big party. All right.
Yeah,
cool.
It is a party. It is 24-hour once it starts.
It is
Thursday night through Monday morning. It's just 24-hour.
Something for everyone, and you might learn about some things you didn't know that were yours, and you'll find out.
Cool.
Thank you, Derek.
All right, well, let's wrap it up. And if you, our listening audience, have any feedback for us on this episode or any episode, we'd love to hear from you. You could send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org, or you could call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.